All my writing before this has been poetry. And over the years in my books of poems, I found the lines kept getting longer. And I think the move towards prose had me working on this journal form, which I've not done. Many people write their journals their entire lives. For me, it's a more dipping in and out of this form of work. I began this segment when my father-in-law was dying, and it began as a small series of prose poems about his decline. And what I found myself wanting to do then is weave in stories from work, how they were intersecting with what was going on at home. And the thought that all analysts, all therapists live in this zone of interwoven stories, where we're following multiple narrative threads at once, but we tend to talk to each other in terms of one case story at a time. So it was important to me to have all those levels present, because that's really what a lived life is being immersed simultaneously in all of those.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Alice Jones. Before I introduce our guest, I'd like to take a moment to honor this particular episode. It is the 200th episode of the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. And when we started this 7 years ago in April 2019, we never figured it would take on the life that it has. It was originated with the support of Virginia Unger and her then board, who supported my interest in doing this. And it had continued to gain support with Harriet Wolfe and her board, and now Herbert Blass, his board, the current president of the IPA. I also want to acknowledge the many emails and notes I received from listeners literally all around the world, as well as postings they put on various podcast websites, reflecting their learning about psychoanalysis, their appreciation of its vibrancy, its nuance, the dedication of the practitioners of it, and fundamentally its ability to help heal individuals. And finally, I do want to acknowledge the many, many colleagues whose work I've had the opportunity to study, and even more importantly, whose spirit I have done my best to try to capture and let the listener get a feel for, because the work that they do, whether it be traveling to various parts of the world or working with refugees or studying new ways to listen to patients on the couch, whatever it is, there is a passion that they bring to it, as well as a deep thoughtfulness and a profound sense of humanity that I am reminded each time of how lucky I and we are to belong to this work and this field. So, thank you. To return to our guest today, Dr. Alice Jones is a personal and consulting analyst at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis, and she is the author of 7 collections of poems. Her latest book is Cadence of Vanishing. She has a collection of essays entitled Poetry, Depth, and Endings in Psychoanalysis, Distant Music, which is forthcoming from Routledge in 2026. And it's a special experience reading this book. It is a book of poetry. It is a book of analysis. It is a book of life. It is all of these things. And she shares with us 5 years of her life as she lives it, and living life in all its vicissitudes include intensive work with patients. And one of the themes of the book is a patient that she worked with for 12 years who ended up dying in that 12th year, terribly prematurely, and what that was like for both of them. One of my favorite sentences from the book is a quote from her grandfather, who was famously directionally challenged. And when he was challenged for this challenge of his, he would say, apparently with a good deal of equanimity, "We are headed in the proper general direction." And I think we can all use that as a model for ourselves in life, in psychoanalysis, in many venues. I learned a great deal from speaking with Alice. I do recommend the book, but it's not of a usual technical book by any means. It is a book of life, and analysis is part of that, and death is part of that. And she shares with it with a poignancy that I think privileges all of us to become a part of. So here's my conversation with Dr. Alice Jones. Alice, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
I'm glad to be here.
You've written an unusual book, and it's unusual, as we will get into it, for many reasons, but we're going to start with the title. The title is Cadence of Vanishing. And what the book is, it's a memoir. It's a memoir of 5 years of your life, your family, your patients, your friends, your poetry, your swimming, your physicianhood comes loud and clear. And ever present is this notion, almost a cloud over you and the characters you write about, of mortality, which relates to one of the themes that runs through the book that we will focus ourselves on. And that is a patient of yours, a patient you call Blake, who was with you for 12 years. And unfortunately, his termination consisted of his dying, almost dying on your couch. Now, this book has been characterized in some of the reviews as a meditative memoir. So before we get into the book itself, why don't you fill us in on what led you to do this and what your thinking was and what you would like the reader to take with it?
All my writing before this has been poetry. And over the years in my books of poems, I found the lines kept getting longer. And I think the move towards prose had me working on this journal form, which I've not done. Many people write their journals their entire lives. For me, it's a more dipping in and out of this form of work. I began this segment when my father-in-law was dying, and it began as a small series of prose poems about his decline. And what I found myself wanting to do then is weave in stories from work, how they were intersecting with what was going on at home. And the thought that all analysts, all therapists live in this zone of interwoven stories, where we're following multiple narrative threads at once, but we tend to talk to each other in terms of one case story at a time. So it was important to me to have all those levels present, because that's really what a lived life is being immersed simultaneously in all of those. The sense of vanishing, that's where the book started. And being the age I am, you can't not think about everything vanishing, not just one's self, one's health, one's friends, but we're in a culture where there's massive destruction and vanishing going on. There are languages vanishing, peoples vanishing. ecology vanishing, species vanishing. So all of that sense of massive background loss, I think we all live inside of. We can't tune into it all the time. The mind can't hold it. But being aware of it, I think, is something that makes life more alive in the present, to be able, when we can hold that. And I think the non-recognition of it makes for a good deal of trouble in the world. The specific title comes from a Galway Canal poem. It also captures cadence, the music of things. And Seamus Heaney has that famous line about the music of what happens. And I think daily life and its rhythms has a good deal of music to it. And I think for the analyst listening to sound all day, there's a musical register we sometimes tune into and sometimes don't, but we're absorbing feeling all the time. For me, the two then perfectly capture something I want for the title of this project, which is both that rhythmicity, the musicality, and the sorrow of what we're immersed in, as well as the beauty of all of it along the way.
Having read sections of the book many times, I slowly became aware of my version of what you just said, which is that you give snippets, and we will go over some of them, of your clinical work. And then yet they will be surrounded by conversations with intimates in your life. And you juxtapose them in a way that I, and I think many of us, don't, which is that we have our clinical work and we bring what we bring to that. And then we live other parts of our lives. And the way you put it to me in your note is that how the analyst lives in multiple narratives simultaneously, and how those interweave with one's personal life, as well as the theme of vanishing. So with that in mind, the listener is in for a treat. Why don't you start us off with, we've selected a number of pieces to introduce the reader, to whet their appetite. And the first one has to do with your experience of yourself as an analyst, if you want to start us off.
Yeah, the entries or pages in this book all have dates rather than titles. Following the journal form. So they have a numeric title. So this one is 2-10-12. A Friday. Another day of intimacy and distance. How this work of psychoanalysis suits me. The intensity, talking several times a week, immersed in each story, each constellation of mind. With my invisibility, the patient speaking on the couch, the face of the other out of sight. This arrangement grants the freedom of not having to think about what my face is doing, whether my eyebrows have ascended in surprise or concern, or whether my tiredness is being read as sorrow. Present this way, I can sense my body, swim in the streams of narrative, pursue multiple branches, hear the echoes of each mingled with my own. And I can speak in a way I've learned to, when words insist themselves, choosing which to put forward, which to let lapse into silence. At times, an outbreath is more than enough of a comment. The field theorists would say the sentences let go are as meaningful as the ones spoken. I don't know. It feels more like what's written and what's not. So many paragraphs I compose in the pool or the car never arrive on paper.
Is there anything you want to elaborate on that? Or, I mean, each one of these, of course, stand on their own, but you might have associations to it.
Yeah, I feel like they both stand on their own and they intersect with whatever the surround is. And my mention of field theory is my sense that what the analyst brings is an entire field of a life to each hour. Not just the field of the transference, counter-transference at the moment, but also the field of is a relative dying? Is the weather beautiful? Has a war begun? All of that is in the field too.
To go to the beginning, the first entry that you make, which is 5-9-11, picks up so many of the themes that you develop throughout, and I'll read this. And you sort of begin this paragraph by saying, the moment I grow old, soon before turning 60, leaving the pool after a Saturday morning workout with my master's team, stepping across the zone between sidewalk and street, buried in oxalis, my foot vanishes into a hidden hole and I fall, smashing my knee on the pavement. Wadding a Kleenex on top of the blood, I drive home, go up to the bathroom for peroxide, put on my reading glasses, part the lips of the cut, see that I can see all the way down to the patellar tendon, go downstairs, get a book, the book is The Waves, and drive to the Alta Bates emergency room. Waiting to be admitted, I read, lost in braided soliloquies, wondering who's who. Spreading the wound open with retractors borrowed from the operating room, the doctor rinses and rinses bits of gravel off the tendon. Sarcastic edged, he is one of those doctors skeptical of psychoanalysis, who can't quite believe I take my work seriously. Since the cleaning and stitching up take half an hour, we talk. And somehow, by the time he is taping down my dressing, he is telling me about his withered mother, wondering whether it's depression or dementia setting in. You have themes of age, of mortality, of medicine, of skeptical physicians who, your patellar may be open and exposed, but he doesn't know that he's doing some opening of his own as you listen, as you do. What else can you say about that? I mean, it sets the book up really beautifully.
Well, I very much wanted that image of inside and outside. That interface, the surface where one breaks into the other, which I think is the zone we're working in analysis, is that however thick or thin that membrane between conscious and unconscious and whatever is below each of those, the sense of the waves meant a lot to me to have a very slight mention of Virginia Woolf in here for several reasons. Not just loving her writing, but her lifelong journal project is on my mind. This particular book, The Waves, she has six intersecting voices. I can't always tell who's who. Each one is telling its own story and they're woven together in an amazing way. So I think this is very much how we hold our patients in mind, the stories we're carrying. And the other thing Virginia Woolf said about her journal is that she wanted it to be a hold-all, meaning it could contain absolutely everything and anything. And I see this book as following that model as well, that whether it's something very personal or something very out there in the world, or whether it's the NASA's photograph of the day of the nebulae, it all fits in. So The Waves is my nod in that direction, to mention that here.
The inside-outside, you juxtapose the body and the mind and the soul.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
You give, some days later, an example of your practice, a sample of your practice on a particular Tuesday, which will, again, orient the listener to what your day is and what you select out from your patients to form a theme for you.
There are several days described like this in the book where I give my schedule and just a sentence or two, or sometimes more of a story about what the day held. So this is 10, 18, 11. A Tuesday work day. I'm a receptacle for story, sensation, words, dreams, and feeling. Stevie, a computational wizard, tells me something she read about Steve Jobs before he died. When he was ill, someone asked what he thought about the afterlife. Jobs said he considered it and decided it was probably an on-off switch. Nothing happens after you die. Claire tells me she has to be sure to not eat for 3 hours before sleep, so as not to encourage her reflux, quite certain she'll get the esophageal cancer that killed her father. An ER doctor, someone trained in putting people back together, not in states of being, tells me about a psychotic man who chopped off the tip of his finger, and about an anorexic who, after a fight with her mother, went out and bought a gun. Mika tells me about her patient, cancer arriving near the start of their work, now years later, widely metastatic, terminal. How to say goodbye to someone you have lived with, suffered with, reached so deeply into, now parting before the work has reached a resting place. A supervisee tells me about her patient, molested as a child by a priest, who wanders in dissociated states, coming to, finding herself standing at the roof edge of a tall building. Matthew can't stand the idea of dying because he's so claustrophobic. Being locked in a box underground terrifies him. So he keeps telling all his siblings, writing in his will, carrying a note in his wallet to make certain that when the time comes, he'll be cremated. Jason tells me about his mother, who at 95 has fallen so many times and broken so many bones that everything hurts. Her mind wanders. She doesn't recognize her helpers, asks where her own mother has gone.
I found when I first read this, it is many things. It's a slice of, a broad slice of human life, the trials and tribulations. As we've said, mortality runs through most of the examples in the book. People are dying, people are terminal, people are afraid of dying. I was also drawn to, and I mentioned this to you when we spoke earlier, that you characterize yourself as a receptacle for story, sensation, words, dreams, and feeling. And when I read that, I thought, well, certainly true, but I see the work as being yes and. Yes, we are receptacles, but we are also metabolizers. And again, that's close to just receiving, but it's also doing something and sharing back something that may be a little bit different than the individual thought about or anticipated in the spirit of maybe expanding their sense of themselves. I don't want to get caught in semantics, but is there a difference between us as we're describing this?
No, of course, everything you said is the job is not just receiving, but transforming.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And encouraging aliveness or growth in whatever ways we can. On this particular Tuesday, I am a receptacle for too much. And I think the too muchness is why I chose that word for this particular day. So it's a particular, not a general, except the receiving instrument is part of it. But on some days it feels like a container that's overflowed. And so I'm describing on this particular day, such an experience.
And then you introduce Blake. Briefly, you say, this is Blake speaking, "My mother wanted me dead. I could feel it." And you write, "The mother gave two of her six children the sense that they were evil, disgusting, and had to be controlled. Blake grew up with this experience of himself, so dangerous it couldn't be known, always hidden from the self who searches." In fact, what you just said about how it's transformed, he says, so dangerous, or you conclude, so dangerous it couldn't be known, but you helped him know it. And in that process, transformed it for him from something he had to live out, presumably, to something he could put into words and affects, and tragically not work with it for as long as he might have wanted to. Anything you want to add on that before we stay on the Blake theme?
No, that entry is in one of these other workday descriptions, and I think, really describes the psychic context he was in when we met, which evolved a great deal over our time together. Mm,
yeah, so it seems. How about if you pick up 14 months later on 3713, again on Blake?
Okay. I'm in Boston. On the phone, Blake says, "I'm scared. Brain surgery is scheduled for Wednesday, and he doesn't know if he will ever be himself again. Will his artistic mind function? Will memory hold? I thought I was weak with one post-surgical body part." This is after my rotator cuff surgery. "Coming to terms with limit. Then see Blake with his questions. Will he be able to work or live out his days disabled? Will he, in his smart way, carve a channel through others' resistances? make arcane administrative systems work for him? Or will he sit on the porch dangling his toes for whatever time remains? Will he lose his new house, hard won, gardened, designed? So one thing that the reader doesn't know yet is that Blake is a high school art teacher, so he has his own artwork, and the design of everything in his surroundings matters to him.
2 days later, you write the following. Blake phones. Rare for me to speak to anyone when I'm on vacation. In fact, you told me this is the first time he's ever called you. He says the tumor they described as pea-sized, thought to be surrounded by 5 centimeters of edema, is actually all tumor, infiltrating the left hippocampus and brainstem. The dreaded word inoperable. Though possibly not malignant at a cellular level, it goes everywhere. It's unknown whether his mind will function after the operation, where they will open his skull, a flap large enough to map the language centers while he's awake enough to speak. I imagine him lying there, brain open to the air, talking, being tested on vocabulary. They'll locate the regions where nerve tissue innervates thought and pharynx, larynx, and vocal cords, places where cellular electricity is transformed into word. Amazing we've arrived here, creatures of language, Blake speaking to me as I paced an outer hallway of the conference, a refugee from the book fair, swamp bed of poets and presses, lit magazines, big foundations filling the large booths, while the artisanal presses hover and cross-pollinate. What I found so moving and graceful about that one paragraph is you go from your patient calling you for the first time with what he takes to be a death sentence, inoperable, and you describe his hippocampus and his surgery opening his flap and the regions where nerve tissue innervates thought, and the literary conference, a book fair, where artisanal presses hover and cross-pollinate. I dare say there hasn't been a paragraph that captures both of those two experiences simultaneously with any of the authenticity that you brought to that. So congratulations on that. It really is quite something.
Thank you. It just seemed like, even in the living of it, such a strange, I mean, the phone call itself was strange, but to be in the Associated Writing Programs Conference, which is a giant book and writers conference, looking for a private space, which I couldn't really find, but some, you know, corner of an atrium somewhere to talk. And like the first section I read, this is one of those images of inside and outside, where the body is open, like the patellar tendon, and the echoes with language going from inside the mind to in a book is also there for me, that translation, that transformation. So the inside-outside generative interface is one of the places that draws me.
I think it's also worth noting that a superficial reading of this could lead some to misunderstand that you're being present both physically and also intellectually and emotionally in the writer's conference would in any way detract you or distract you from being attuned to Blake's calamity. And you make perfectly clear in your writing and for me in our speaking that is far from the case, that you are fully in both moments and probably better in both moments because there were those two moments would be my hypothesis. But I wouldn't know that, but I would imagine it. How about if you continue on reading about Blake and his fear at the bottom of the page?
This is an entry later in the same day. Blake called because of fear, wanting an adult to listen. One who can manage her own fear in the face of his. Let his have full voice, not bring mine. To soothe, I only say, so many unknowns. We're held there for a moment, just breathing together, on the cell phone's fragile line. A thread tying me to him, as we've been tied for 12 years. I have no idea which of the sounds I make are transmitted. Vicissitudes of cross-continental sound, entering what mind, shared bowl, as we imagine ourselves inside the cranium, where I haven't been since anatomy lab 40 years before. We hold this thought, interlocked fingers, writers walking by. A woman in a sleek winter coat laughs into her phone. In the opposite corner of the lobby, I feel we are inverse images, her dark skin, my white skin, verbal, quiet, joy, sorrow, she in her corner, I in mine. Pacing, no idea how far I walk during this call. But the rocking step is soothing when it's my job not to soothe but to witness, to acknowledge that neither of us knows if we will be saying goodbye soon to the other's presence in the fabric of a life, known at a level I know few others. There being no family members I speak to so deeply, one to one, 5 hours a week, for years. The most frightening thoughts, the intensities, dailiness, pushing up against the phobias, the neglect, hate, and finding a self growing there who had seemed at one time to be close to death or beyond. As a child, Blake was invaded daily by his mother's mind. The mother said, "I know you're scared," when the child had felt no fear, but the mother had and disavowed it. Blake came to feel, "I'm a place for my mother to put her garbage," began to experience himself as hideous. The child became afraid of his own rage, because when angry, his mother would tell him he was abusive, the cause of all harm. Even when hitting, the mother would say it's Blake's fault, then would torture him for wanting to be separate.
Alongside the tragic aspects of his childhood that you're touching upon, you also mention another unique aspect of our field. You write, speaking of yourself, "No family member I speak to so deeply, to one-on-one, 5 hours a week for years." That is one of the oddities of our work. We are in some special way intimate with people as no other form of intimacy. And perhaps in some ways it's more intimate because it doesn't include the physical. But it is nevertheless a profound intimacy. And we will get to in a later conversation about what that's like, not only in the rest of our lives, in our friends and our relationships to the outside world and nature, but also with our own lovers and spouses and family members and how one negotiates that. I want to switch us away briefly from Blake. It's metaphorically connected because it has to do with mortality, but it's from a different angle. And it's 5 months later, you report in the book a dream. And your dream is as follows. "I am at body work for my shoulder, and the guy asks me some question I can't answer. He says, 'Is there anyone you could call who would know?' So I pick up the phone and call my old analyst. It's good to talk with her after so many years, but I can't just ask one question and go back to the body work. I see the guy waiting and think, I'll just have to pay him for a session I'm not having. I tell my analyst that I broke my clavicle, and she says something about her health, and that after she retired, she wanted to go back to studying the classics, but that her brain couldn't do it. Sad. I think that because I only have a minute to talk to her, I better get serious now. I tell her that it's strange to do my analytic work without her. I tell her I have conversations with her in my head still and how valuable her presence is to me. Then she is in the room with us, sitting on the floor, and the bodywork guy tells her a story about when he met the Queen of England. Embarrassed, I wake touched to have spoken to her. Then remembering, she's been dead for about 12 years. She never retired until she was told she was dying, then left her work suddenly, several years after I had ended. After I had been working with her for 6 or 7 years, one day I commented that beside the freeway I took to her office, the retaining wall under construction for several years was now complete. And I'd noticed they planted vines, which would one day cover the wall. She said, quote, "So even long projects come to completion." Realizing she meant us, I yelled, "No, no, no." I guess my natural inclination is to ask for your associations to the dream.
I'm not going to quite go there, but I will say it's, for me, the dream is a wonderful image of how the analyst resides in the patient's mind, not just during analysis, but this is many years later. And to have an abiding, good object presence is a wonderful gift when that can occur. And that you can see I'm still working something out in relation to her all these years later. And she's still functioning as my analyst, even though we terminated long before, and even though she's no longer alive.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a lesson we can all relate to, that analysts do and don't die in reality and in our minds. And I think it's part of your particular honesty and transparency throughout the book where you bring that in, including, I don't know if you intended this or whether it's true, you said she never retired until she was told she was dying and then left to work suddenly. There's so much conversation now about retirement and end of life and dementia and illness. Was that included in that? Was there something about how she left her work that stayed with you, raised questions for you? I know you were long out by then.
I was out, but you know, knowing people in the analytic community for whom that was an abrupt and awful ending, I do think about how we all depart this work and how best to prepare for that, both in ourselves and with our patients, and who will inform our patients if anything happens suddenly, and how to make a transition that's not sudden, though in terms of health, there's so much we can't control and can't predict.
Yeah. It's a terribly challenging situation for the analyst and the analyst's end. And rarely, in my experience, is it done the way everybody wished it would have been done in retrospect?
Yeah, I was just, I had a paper in a special issue of the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, which was focused on termination. And of the 6 or 7 analysts who wrote papers about this, many addressed this question of how do we retire? How do we say goodbye? How do we prepare for endings? And the you know, the ending we hope does not happen is where the analyst or the patient dies.
Certainly. We return to Blake, but with a little bit of, I don't know if I'd call it humor, serendipity to it. It's on, it's 1 month later, 9/4/13. If you could read that.
Blake returns after his very low platelet count and low white count rose sufficiently, resuming his chemotherapy. Vomiting, all the fear came back. The one of being trapped in the arms of a poisonous mother, one who's gotten inside him. Then, around the same time, he met a friend of a friend and got together with this nice-sounding man, caring, unlike some in the past. And I want for him all the love, sex, and affection he can find. After he leaves, in my mind's ear, Janis Joplin sings, "Get It While You Can." I watch it on YouTube, remembering when Peter and I went downtown to East 4th Street looking for a winter coat for me and found a secondhand store selling raggedy black seal fur coats in a 1920s style, high wing-like collar. Posing, I looked in the mirror, and behind me was Joplin trying on a twin coat at the same time. And catching the eye of each other's reflections, we smiled.
Again, it's one of the, I smile in reading it and rereading it. Again, you talk about Blake and his chemo and his low white blood cell in the same writing as you talk about the delight of encountering Joplin. And it's all part of your life, each with its own gravitas and playfulness. And that's what I'm taking away from this work, about how life is just folded onto itself. And one doesn't have to preferentially weight one thing over another. They're all filled with meaning if one bothers to listen.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I hope for in the book as a whole, that mix of life and death, playfulness and seriousness, that they are, and past and present, that they're all simultaneous.
Well, just to, before we return to Blake, there's this just precious little thing that you wrote that I want to read. It's from 9/25/13. You write, "In the early 1930s, when my father was a boy, many years pre-interstate, his father would drive the family from Ohio to Florida in the winter. On two lanes, they often got lost. My father and his aggressive, boisterous brother, so impatient, would yell at their scholarly father, who would reply in his measured way, 'We are headed in the proper general direction.'" I love that. "We are headed in the proper general direction." My father quoted this so often that even though I never met Grandfather Ralph, I quote his saying whenever we are bumbling, misguided, and lost. And we could have titled the podcast that, because it so sort of graciously characterizes analysis so often. We don't know exactly where we are, but we have a fairly good idea of generally where we're going, which is quite a lot, I might add.
Well, there's also going back to the deadliness. We know the general direction we're headed in the sense of mortality. Also, that's there.
I was afraid you were going to bring that up. I was really
bring it down right when you're having fun.
Yeah, I was more in the playful space. There's always that mortality, huh? All right, which brings us back to pain. Why don't you start us off on page 200 for pain?
Let's see, this is 9/4/14, and it begins with a quote from Pat Barker in her novel, Life Class. "Perhaps pain, even other people's pain, becomes a smell you carry around with you. When I come home cranky, Kay asks, 'Your anger or someone else's?' He's learned this about my work. There are permeable days and ones that are less so. There are people whose only way to know their experience is to see it coming back at them, having looped through my mind, my register of emotions. There are those who know nothing about this and those who watch me suffer it, hold it, endure for a while until whatever it is enters the realm of language."
I was so moved by this when your husband asks, "Your anger or someone else's?" Number one, that he is aware of those possibilities. And it implies that you have a clarity about it being one or the other, which bedevils me because, and I understand it may not be as clear to you as he said it, but I think we all know what it's like to feel sort of swimming in it, though you stay with your imagery, and not clear which is coming from where. But it also brings up the whole topic, as I mentioned before, about what our intimates know about our work, perhaps not details, but certainly themes, and how they live with us having these intense relationships with other people, other men, other women, which includes often for both parties erotic aspects. And you glance on this in the book. Is there anything more that you want to take it to, or should we leave it there?
Going along with my theme of inside and outside, and back to that word receptacle that you picked up on, there are a lot of images of various forms of containers and being held. And it's a very small picture of how I'm held in this marriage, which is somebody can recognize both the impact of my work and my own responses to it, and be curious and containing and compassionate towards all of those. So that to me feels like quite a gift to be understood in that way. And I don't go on about it in the writing, but there it is.
It certainly is a gift. But staying true to the general direction we're going, we return to Blake now. This is 5 weeks later. I'll read a piece and then I'll ask you to read a few pieces that will take us to the end. This is on 10/14/14. "Today, Blake is angry, having fought his way to a safe place. Now he wants nothing other than to leave life quickly, without treatment, without fear, without the daily effort of trying to perform at his accustomed level of competence. He imagines torturing his parents by not seeing them. I silently agree. He would feel safer leaving them out, but I also think he will want some kind of goodbye. His regularly scheduled scan will be Wednesday, but he has gone far ahead with his end-of-life planning without any confirmation. Is he racing ahead or am I lagging behind? Grateful. He says without our work, he would not have lived through his 20s. And he's angry being yanked away right when things were getting easier. Sad, he feels the one thing he wishes he had done is to become a father. And at the same time, he's very glad there is no child to leave behind, someone growing up without him. We've begun our farewell before the diagnosis arrives, and both feel the grinding gears of endings that began long ago, and we were only partly willing to admit. The grinding gears of endings, like many things, have multiple meanings. It is said that the first session of even an open-ended long treatment contains the seeds of its termination. And I don't know if that's what you're including in the grinding gears of ending that began long ago.
I am thinking of that, how, you know, before day one of an analysis, we know there will be an ending. Mm-hmm. We don't know, will we even begin? And then when we begin, we know it will end at some point, not knowing soon or late or how, or will it end well and productively, or will it break in some other way? That's there, I think, with every relationship, and that's the vanishing that I think we all carry without consciousness much of the time.
Can you pick up on 2:16? There are a few excerpts I'd like you to read.
Yeah. This one is 10:18:14. Yesterday in my office, Blake said he feels his brain more gone each day. We talk about how far we've come in our work, wishing he had more time, pleased with what time there is, recognizing the closeness he's built on top of the sub-basement of fear that lives inside. Giving away one of his paintings, saying goodbye to a younger man he mentors, seeing him cry. He says that all he's taught to his students will remain. He leaves those riches behind. And what about the value of our hours upon hours, making room for growth that will now come to its end?
Then we go to 10:23:14.
Today, the ends of Blake's sentences trail off. Is he over-medicated? Brain edema? I think this might be the last day we're able to talk. During a silence, I wonder if he has died, and I think how it would be for him to die here on my couch. Leaving, Blake bumps into the door, can't manage his way out. Opening the door, I ask if it's okay if I help, take him by the elbow, and lead him down the stairs where a friend, whose name I don't know, is waiting in the car to take him home. And it occurs to me reading it that this is probably the first time I've ever touched him.
Huh.
When he's no longer able to walk steadily, then I escort him. I escort him on the way out.
After asking if it was okay, I want to note that as well.
The next one is on 10:24:14. The next day, I have a dream. Blake has come to my office, which now has many rooms and maybe my house. This is his last day alive, and he says he wants to spend it cooking with me, soy something. I say, okay, if this is what he wants. Later, I find him lying on the floor, curled up but breathing, and then his relatives come looking for him. In real life, he comes in wobbly, lies down. He says, I wish I could die here. I say, with me? He says, yes. Here? He says, that would be nice. Right. I want you to be with me when I die. Do you do that? I say, do you mean, will I make it happen? He says, yes. I say, I can't do that, but if you want me there, I will do what I can to be there and to see you each day between now and then. His image of death is one of being conscious up to the last minute, closing his eyes and going in an instant. I'm both asking about the fantasy and wanting to make a real plan. I'm thinking of how my stepfather approached death, and I wonder if Blake will be conscious, will fade away quietly. He says, that would be terrible. That's awful. I want out the back door, slip away, like knock down over the cash register and go. I say, I will come see him when he's no longer able to get here, and I think that may be Monday. I ask permission to speak to the friends who drove him today to make a plan. During the session, he drifts in and out, at times more delirious, and I slowly take it in. This is our last time together here. The next day, strange intimacy, 5 hours a week for many years, thousands of hours speaking what the bones want to speak, what the mind utters and flesh dictates, the net of another's mind tries to hold. I couldn't do my job at the end. Having imagined sitting beside him as he left the world of consciousness, I have to picture others playing that part. I know none of them knows his fears, his longings so deeply, but assume they will surround him with love as he leaves.
Anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that is itself.
Yes. 4 months later, there is an entry that remains about mortality, but now it's your own that you mention. And you say, Dr. Mascherani phones to say my thyroid biopsy was benign. Mark, a patient, is here saying, I have no internal infrastructure, but now that I've been here 10 years, there is something of an external structure. Later, I look it up and find that we have just passed the 12th year mark. He speaks about his aging father, a dying nephew, time and its vagaries, and I have a stray thought, wondering if he will attend my funeral and provide one of the witty, eloquent remarks for which he is known. Whether he will attend our funeral, I suspect that is not that unusual a thought for an analyst who knows someone well and who perhaps speaks eloquently. And we would like to be the somehow a beneficiary of that eloquence, even if in death. Was there anything particular about that for you?
I don't remember the particular line of thought enough to know how I got to my funeral while he was talking about his developing an external structure. Mm-hmm. And it probably began with a thought about how many more years will we be talking? And will that be enough for him to ever really terminate? And will I last that long? And then it's again something about language would be the thing still connecting us even when I'm not no longer there.
As you describe in your dream with your analyst.
Yeah, it's a mirror image of that, yeah. Of that line of thought.
Yes, yes. Alice, before I ask you to close with your reading the last poem from the book from which the title comes, I do want to share with you what my experience has been like reading the book. When I first opened it, I was daunted. It is not a usual analytic book, and it is not a usual poetry book, and it is not fiction. It's inside outside. It's fiction, nonfiction. One doesn't know what's not said in a memoir, but immersing myself in it over a period of time, and even more so speaking with you, as I said, I'm really left not only moved by your ability to live in multiple spheres at one time, but apart from admiring that, it also broadens my own awareness of it, how we are all doing it all the time. It's just that our brains and psychologies are such that it isn't an easy thing to do. When we do it, it is both very pleasurable, but terribly humbling, is my experience, that there isn't a straight line. We are generally going in the right direction, we hope, as you point out. But there's so much happening at all time. And our patients and our immersion in their lives and their immersion in our minds in their own way is part of our unique work. But as you say, it is juxtaposed against the many other things that are happening in our life. And they, the patients, the work, and we are enriched by trying to let as much of that in as possible. And so even as you persistently remind us of our mortality, I still thank you for expanding my awareness of really what it means to be human. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And we certainly can't be conscious of everything we know at once, and that's a blessing as well as our struggle.
Yeah.
But back to Virginia Woolf, I really very much wanted this to be something that can contain everything, and that both the interior and the exterior life are equally real, and that the realness of a life is something that accumulates in all these small particulate moments of aliveness.
And with that, I invite you to read the final poem.
This is 5/16/16. On Montgomery Street in San Francisco, I'm early for an analytic candidate's clinical development meeting at Pink. Hungry, I find a sad pizza place blaring tinny music, populated by some after-office hangers-out. Eating a slice, I watch the giant TV screen where the Oklahoma Thunder demolish the San Antonio Spurs. I'm eager to see the game because the victor will be the next team facing our Golden State Warriors in the playoffs. During a timeout, my eyes wander to the wall beside the TV. How could I not have seen the 6-foot-tall Galway Canal poem set in large white plastic type against a green wall? And here's Galway. If you commit then, as we did, the error of thinking, one day all this will be memory. Learn to reach deeper into the sorrows to come, to touch the almost imaginary bones under the face, to hear the laughter, the wind crying across the black stones. Kiss the mouth that tells you, here, here is the world, this mouth, this laughter, these temple bones, the still undanced cadence of vanishing.
Alice, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.